Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Kai Wortmann, working in philosophy of education at the University of Tübingen in Germany. And I'm here today with Bernard Harcourt, who is a professor of law and professor of political science at Columbia University in New York. We want to talk about his new book, Critique and Praxis, a critical philosophy of illusions, values, and action. In this book, Bernard focuses on the possibility and necessity of social critique as a praxis. Hi, Bernard. I must confess that the book looked quite daunting to me. It was big, heavy, a dark black cover, almost 700 pages, and I had a look in the content and counted the names of the critical theory giants. It was 17 names in the content alone. But when I opened the book and actually start reading, I was really surprised how accessible and also intellectually stimulating the writing is.
Oh, good. I'm glad you liked it.
So I'm really happy to have you here. Bernard, welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, thank you so much, Kai. I'm delighted to be here because the book is intended to open conversations, not close them, and open a whole world, really, of critical theory and praxis. So I'm delighted to be with you.
Before talking about the book, can you maybe start off by saying a little bit about your background? So what brought you into critical theory?
Right. Well, I really have a kind of a mixed background or multiple different backgrounds that collided in my younger years and that collide in this book. One of my backgrounds is that early on I became an attorney, and I started to represent people on death row down in Alabama in the southern part of the United States. And I did that early on. I worked with a wonderful attorney, small set of lawyers. Worked with Brian Stevenson, who's at a small office. It was a public interest office that's now called the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. And I was really engrossed in those death penalty cases and in that representation. And I've never left that. I continued even as I went into the academy later on and continued with my cases and still today represent folks who are on death row in Alabama. And other places. So that was one way in which I got kind of brought to this work. The other was more theoretical. I studied political theory. I was really taken by notions of critical theory, questions of punishment and political economy. I worked with an extraordinary political theorist when I was younger, Sheldon Wolin, and decided to return to that area and to explore it more and to really mine critical theory. So I ended up getting a PhD under the supervision of Sheila Ben-Habib, who is a brilliant critical theorist, trained in the Frankfurt School. And eventually, my theoretical research focused and then developed the work of Michel Foucault on prisons and punishment. And I gradually became an editor of Michel Foucault's work. And I was fortunate enough to edit his lecture series on the punitive society and his lecture series on penal theories and institutions. And I was fortunate enough to edit his book, Discipline and Punish, Surveiller et Punir, for the French Gallimard edition of the complete works. And so it was really mostly those two backgrounds that collided and came together. And so my work on the death penalty, actually representing people on death row or now someone at Guantanamo Bay, coming into kind of complete confrontation and clash with my theoretical work on Foucault, on Discipline and Punish, which, of course, as you know, opens with that famous scene of the torturous execution of Damien in 1757. And it's that confrontation of practice and theory that really has driven my ambitions, my life, and that drives this work, critique and praxis.
I must confess that Discipline and Punish was a great formative reading in during my studies, and in a sense, I can also relate the style of your writing to Foucault's, since you also employ a very nice mix of theoretical analysis, personal reflections, and in your book also examples from fictional literature, which I also really enjoyed reading. And I thought I really struggled how to deal with a 600 pages book in 1 hour. And I thought that one way of staying true to the book is being a bit critical of critique and offering you thereby the opportunity to position yourself within the variety of critical theory and also relate to praxis. Because I thought that really one of your... Oh, now I'm already giving away the point of the book. But one point I thought that you were making very strongly in the book was that emphasis on praxis that is not only theoretical.
Right, right. Yeah, I think you're right to start from the critique of critical theory in a way. From taking a critical position to critical theory. And that is where the book began, with a certain dissatisfaction or frustration with the abstract and kind of excessively theoretical at times, or too highly philosophical and unrelated to the world, that much critical theory became towards the end of the 20th century, as it retreated from the public sphere, I would say, to the academy. Critical theory critical theory itself, there are different people define it in different ways, trace it in different ways, and trace its origin to different times. In its very kind of narrow sense, critical theory with a big C and a big T is often associated with the Frankfurt School and Horkheimer and Adorno, and then eventually Habermas. I try to draw a wider lineage and a more copious notion of critical theory that really finds its roots in the 19th century with Marx and Nietzsche, who are uncomfortable bedfellows, and of course very much in tension and in conflict. But earlier in the 19th century, and then more generous and copious in the 20th century, to include thinkers like Deleuze or thinkers like Foucault or eventually Derrida. So not to limit critical theory to the kind of post-Marxist turn in the 1920s and 30s, but to really speak about it copiously, to include queer theory and critical race theory and post-colonial theory in the mix. But even when I do that, and so in trying to make it as contemporary and relevant as possible today, it really does feel that critical theory did retreat to a high form of kind of philosophical and aesthetic pristineness as it kind of retreated into the academy. And so whereas it was more part of public discourse in the mid-20th century, I think towards the end of the 20th century, it really became the language and the rhetoric of certain highly theorized works in the university, whether it was in a department of rhetoric or in a department of English, and it became less accessible, very jargony, much and hard to understand really, and also very distant from kind of the material on the ground efforts of trying to transform the world, to change the world and make it more just and equitable and more social justice. And so I think that the book itself comes from a critique of critical theory and reflects that in very much, it's very much a conversation with the direction that the Frankfurt School took. It's very much a conversation with the direction that critical theory took in the work of Michel Foucault and other post-structuralists and post-colonial thinkers. And what I try to do in the work is return to the origins of the critical impulse, which I would argue is about changing the world, and to try to tease out how we would, in fact, use a critical lens to help us in our critical praxis, in the ways in which we're trying to transform the world. And that's precisely where the legal advocacy that I've done and the activism and the organizing on the legal side comes into conversation with the theoretical work of critical theory. To a certain extent, I was always dissatisfied with the idea that critical theory itself or engaging in critical thought could be a form of praxis itself. I always thought that that was too limited. It wasn't enough. It's not enough, I feel, for us in the academy, or even slightly beyond the academy, to have a sense that we are, in fact, engaging in praxis when we are engaging critical theory. That seems to me to be not enough. Writing books is not enough. Thinking, engaging in analyses of crisis is not enough. It's an important, it's a necessary foundation, but it itself is not enough. And so what this book does from that kind of critical perspective on critical theory is to try to develop a way to engage in practices, critical practices that are informed by critical theory, or that in conversation or in contrast or in confrontation with critical theory. And that is really what I do in the book, and it pushed me in a certain direction in the sense that originally I thought that the question to ask at the end of the day is, you know, what is to be done in the famous tradition of activist thought? You know, what is to be done? But I realized as a result of the confrontation with critical theory, with critical thinkers such as post-colonial thinkers such as Edward Said or Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak and others, with Foucault himself and his turned practices of the self, with the confrontation with queer theory and Judith Butler's work, it became clear to me that it was not possible anymore for anyone from a critical praxis perspective to be telling others what is to be done. And so ultimately, I turn the question on its head and I ask, what more am I to do? Now, in the process then of this kind of confrontation of critical theory and critical praxis and raising the question, what more am I to do? It becomes more self-reflexive. It becomes more engaged with my own interventions, my own work, whether it's on the death penalty or at Guantanamo or Standing Rock. And it becomes an analysis of how one should think through, right? How I should think through my own actions and my own practices in order to render them more, not just more effective, but more true to the ambition of transforming the world and pushing it in a direction of solidarity and equality and social justice. So that's how I would kind of phrase it in response to your question. It grew out of a critique of critical theory, but it retains or it tries to rebuild a conception of critical theory, which I talk about through this theory of illusions, to rebuild that in order to make it more directly in conversation with critical praxis.
So one common strand of critique of critical theory is that critical theory has an overly negative vocabulary. And you just said it's not about telling other people what to do. But I wonder whether, for example, the notion of illusion, which is also in the title of the book, has this kind of break with the view of normal people. Since the critical theorists, of course, has a kind of deeper insight into the illusion of the other people. Right. How would you respond to that?
Yeah. Okay, so you're raising two really important questions in there, and I want to make sure I address them both. I mean, one is the question of the negative or the negativity of a critical theory. And then the other is this question of kind of the expertise of critical theory. In other words, is it something that, you know, you only an elite has access to the critique and the notion of illusion that befuddles all of the masses? So let me take those separately because I think they raise different and important issues. The first is the question of negativity. So, I mean, is critique one of the criticisms of critical theory, one of the criticisms of critique, is that it is founded on and does nothing more than kind of negate, than criticize, than critique particular efforts, including efforts to make the world better. Right? Oftentimes it's associated with this move of the kind of the unintended bad consequences of someone trying to help in a situation. So negativity and the notion of negation is very important in critical theory, but I think that it's important to understand that it's one moment in that in one moment in what tends to be the critical moves. So generally, and in part, negativity is so important because of the Hegelian and dialectical origins of a lot of critical theory. Now, a lot of critical theory. I mean, so, you know, Deleuze, for instance, who I would argue is at the heart of critical theory, turns to Nietzsche rather than Marx and Hegel. And in part, his work is anti-dialectical. I mean, it's a rejection of the dialectic. So rejection of this idea of, you know, negation and then overcoming that is tied to the Hegelian dialectic.
Or indeed, in the case of Adorno, staying negative as long as you can. So not even aiming at overcoming.
Right, right, right. And exactly. So I think that so you're pointing to this notion of kind of pure negativity in Adorno. Which he called the negative dialectic. So not even getting beyond the negation to the point of overcoming. It's definitely true that a lot of critical theory is steeped in that, and some, as you just mentioned, stays there. But I would say that there are ways to think through critical theory that do involve not necessarily a Hegelian overcoming, but a constructive element to it. Now, it's often those constructive elements that get criticized, but I think that they can be an integral part of critical theory. So let me give you an example, and that has to do with Du Bois's work, W.E.B. Du Bois, whose work, particularly on the notion of abolition democracy, is so important today, particularly in the United States, with all of the abolitionist movements and all of our thinking about abolition democracy. Now, he developed that term in a book, Black Reconstruction in America, that was published in 1935. And that notion of abolition democracy was essentially a notion that depended on negation, which was the negation of slavery, the elimination, the abolition of slavery. But what Du Bois argued was that abolition alone was not sufficient, and that negative moment had to be accompanied by the creation of new institutions and new practices and new ways of thinking and new ways of being that would put the persons who had formerly been enslaved in a position to be full members of a democracy. And so in Du Bois's work, the notion of abolition, or what he called abolition democracy, is tied to that first element of negation, which is emancipation, the elimination of slavery, but requires at the same time the formulation of new ways of being and all kinds of institutions of education, for voting, for economics, and for jobs and work, etc., and labor, all kinds of institutions that were absolutely necessary in order to guarantee the ambition of the negation, right? In other words, abolishing slavery, that negative moment, was not enough. That was the whole point of his book, Black Reconstruction in America, that it was just not enough. There had to be this second moment of creation of institutions, I would argue a third moment of a transformation of political economy, that without those, the negation just it replicates itself. And that was, of course, Du Bois's point. Slavery, which was abolished, replicated and reproduced itself in the forms of Jim Crow, when there wasn't the kind of positive moment and the constructive moment associated with the negation. So I think that that's a good example, for instance, of why critical theory does not need to be only negative. But it's true that in certain strands, particularly Adorno, even sometimes Foucault, there's this idea that that critical theory should not participate in the reconstructive project. I think that's an illusion. It's an illusion because it assumes that the first act, the negativity itself, is not a constructive act, right? So I really confront. There's this passage where Foucault says he's asked in an interview, "What do we do, you know, after critique?" And he says, "Well, you know, you have to stop at critique because the moment you go further, the moment you start to propose things, you're starting to propose relations of power. You are starting to rebuild forms of domination." And you know that I think that's wrong. That was wrong because the critique itself is a proposal. It is a construction. In other words, what objects we decide to criticize are themselves, that is a choice. And in that choice, we are effectively already reconstructing, not just negating, we're already reconstructing. So in that sense, on the first question, on the question of negativity, I would say it's a fair criticism of certain ways of engaging in critical theory, but it's something I think that we need to overcome in a way.
Thank you for saying that, because I got really angry at Foucault when I read this precise passage, right, when he said that we need to stay critical and proposing something is already participating in the
yeah, kind of, it's already participating
of the bad.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
And when I relate this,
yeah, go ahead.
When I relate this to my own field, the field of education, mm-hmm. I feel like to make it very concrete, when the critical academic goes into schools and looks around and says, well, this is bad and that is also bad, and you're only reproducing the inequalities of society, and also teachers are in principle racists. Mm-hmm. They risk to lose their function also as intellectuals to provide a minimal account of orientation and guidance and propose something to move forward and not only to say what goes wrong.
Right, right. And it's clear that when those critiques are being made, there are conceptions of justice that are embedded in them. In other words, it's not possible to criticize without having particular values that are part of the critique. And that's why I argue that we need to return to those values that are at the heart of the tradition of critical theory, really, values of solidarity, values of equality, values of social justice, because they're embedded in the critical moment. And of course, in that critical moment is embedded a vision, a better vision of society, and one that we need to be, as critical theorists, working on, right? I mean, that's the effort of critical theory and praxis is not simply the deconstructive moment of taking things apart using our values, but it has to be, and it is necessarily important, because that first part is part of trying to change the world and transform the world.
I love that, because am I getting you right? Because as I understand you now, you're saying not only Foucault was wrong or it was problematic what he said, but you also make the claim that in a sense he was wrong about his own critical practice. So he
yes.
gave a kind of illusionary description of his own way of writing, but also, of course, political engagement in the world.
Right. Yeah. Now, you know, he's an interesting figure because he said those things, but at the same time, he was doing different things and engaging in praxis, particularly. So this is particularly around the time of Discipline and Punish, which is published in 1975. But the years leading to Discipline and Punish were, for him, very activist years. In 1970, 1971, he helps found, but a leaderless organization. So although he helps found it, the idea of it was that it wouldn't have founders, but he and a few others founded this organization called the Prison Informations Group, the GIP, the Groupe d'Information sur les Prisons. And it was intended to be a vehicle for persons in prison to be heard, essentially. And it involved, it engaged in a lot of organizing work, trying to get surveys into prisons, trying to get surveys out of prison, which was very difficult at the time in France. It was impossible. The walls of the prison were much less porous than they are today with, you know, cell phones and whatnot. But it was impossible to actually get into the prison and to get words out of the prison because everything was so highly policed at the time. But this his activism, his organizing, and his work were very constructive, but it's important to understand that they were constructive in a particular way. Actually, his work on the prison, to me, is a bit of a model of the way one might want to think about the conflict between theory and praxis. Let me just discuss that for a minute. I realize it's a bit of a digression because I also wanted to get to the second part of the question, which was about elitism. So I'll come to that later, but let me just follow this thread. He was originally invited to conduct or to preside over a popular tribunal in the same way that Jean-Paul Sartre had presided over a popular tribunal in northern France, in Lens. They were putting on trial the mining industry that was sacrificing lives, the lives of miners. And so they put together a popular trial, and Sartre was kind of the prosecutor and the judge and whatnot, and speaking very much for everyone and judging very much. And Foucault was invited by Daniel Rancière and other Maoists, young Maoists, to have a popular tribunal of the prison system. This is 1970. It's early still. Today, in a country like the United States, we have mass incarceration, 2.3 million people. I mean, just inordinate numbers of persons caught in cages in the mesh in America. But at the time, in 1970, there wasn't mass incarceration in the U.S. or in France, but it was beginning to be an issue, and there was a huge repression of the Maoists in France, and 200 Maoists had been incarcerated. And so he was asked to run a popular tribunal, and he was like, his response was, well, this is an important issue, I need to get involved, but it's not going to be through a popular tribunal. Instead, it's going to be through this device where the idea is for us to let the prisoners be heard themselves. Now, you'll notice, of course, that's intimately tied to his work on discourse analysis, on the way in which he was studying the way we speak, what gets heard, how discourses are conveyed, how the mad is portrayed, for instance, and it was precisely from that methodological, theoretical perspective, that Foucault did not want to be the speaker for the prisoners, right? And instead, he wanted to create a vehicle, this prison informations group, whereby the prisoners themselves could be heard, their requests, their desires, what was important to them. And so that was the process that it went. But you have to see, of course, that is a confrontation and resolution in part of theory and praxis, right? He took a very hard look, a hard examination at how he felt his own praxis should move forward. And not simply by using the traditional devices that have been used, but by incorporating the critique of discourse, of who gets heard. The JIP dissolves the day that the prisoners began to form their own committee, the CAP, it was the Prisoners Action Committee. Basically, it was formed by prisoners. The moment that they were able to form their own committee, the JIP dissolves, because the whole purpose of it was, in a way, to create a space for the prisoners to be heard. And so that's a good example, of course. Now, so just to say, there are times when I think Foucault responded in ways that weren't actually necessarily faithful to what he was doing himself, right? So when he says, after critique, no, we can't do anything, we can't propose anything. Well, he was involved in a lot of activity and activism himself, and he was proposing things. But you're entirely right, Kai, that even the initial critical impulse is itself proposing something. Because it's founded on particular values, and it's founded on a particular vision of society, and so it proposes. But I honestly believe, and that's the point, and the whole purpose of this book is to push us more to engage in the kind of thought that does involve proposing and constructing, with the idea, right, that we're going to err. We're going to make mistakes. We're going to ultimately reproduce other illusions that are going to have bad consequences. But we have to accept that. And that's why, in part, the critical theory part of it, or the theoretical part of it, is a theory of illusion. What I call a theory of illusions, by which I mean a theory of the inevitability of producing illusions as one engages in the act of unveiling illusions. And that's very important to me. This idea that we need to be proposing. As we propose, we will be effectively reconstructing certain illusions that we will need to critique later, but we can't let that stop us. That can't let us stop us from proposing and from moving forward and from really trying to change the world, even if we are undoubtedly going to be making errors on that path. So quickly, to get back to the question of elitism, and to a certain extent, which was a critique, the second part of the question you were asking, and it is a critique of critical theory, this idea that, well, only a few anointed intellectuals, say, have the ability to see the truth, or that there are illusions, whereas the mass of ordinary persons are just kind of blinded by blinded by these illusions. Which is a critique of the theories of ideology in a way. I think that's why I would say we need to render the work accessible to all. That's why this book is a criticism of the way in which critical theory became too effete, became too sophisticated, became too aestheticized, became too highly theorized, or so philosophically at such heights of deconstructive work that few people, and when with so much jargon, that few people could understand what was going on. The basic impulse it should not be unfamiliar. The basic impulse here is to try to lift the veils of illusions that mislead us, right? One of those that I've spent years working on is this illusion of the free market. The idea that there could be free markets that regulate our economic exchange in an equilibrium. And that if we don't do anything, if the government doesn't do anything, then just, you know, supply and demand will make it such that everything works out fine. And when there's a little bit too much demand, the price will go up. When there's less, the price will go down. But everything will work out perfectly as long as the government doesn't do anything. And I've spent years challenging that idea because it rests on this fundamental illusion that there could be a space that is unregulated. That's a complete illusion. There are no spaces. And the government, in order to create quote-unquote free markets, the government is always extremely active to create these. Now, I think that idea, I call it an illusion, but what I would say is it's a way of thinking about the world that is common to most of us, that common to many in Western neoliberal industrialized societies, but it's essentially misleading, and it results in policies that are detrimental to justice and equality. Now, I think I don't think it's a question of being elitist or expertise. I think it's something that anyone can understand once we start talking about it. Once we start really having full exchanges over it. And so what I'd like to think is that critical theory doesn't need to be elitist or, rest on such expertise, but it can just depend on more frank exchange and conversation. In the way in which maybe Paulo Freire, a great educator who, of course, plays such a great role in your universe of education theory, tried to suggest that, you know, knowledge is not something that is possessed by some and given to others, but it's something that we all have, and that can kind of thrive when we are given opportunities to exchange on equal footing, with respect and dignity for each other. So that's how I think I would respond to the second conventional critique, which is that this is an elitist enterprise where only certain people have the knowledge. That I think is entirely wrong. But I think that a theory of illusions where we are cognizant of their repetition, the fact that there will be again and again different kind of misleading ideas is something that can be much more on common ground as long as we do have more common discussion, frank discussion, open communication, and exchange. So hopefully that's helpful with those criticisms.
Can I quickly follow on this, because I'm really interested in the modus of critique, and you just said that the way to speak about illusions is lifting the veil, and my question really is that strategically a good way of talking, of conducting these open exchanges, wouldn't it be more equal if we don't say this is an illusion and please follow me in seeing that it is only an illusion, but more saying that look, this is another way of seeing it. Don't you think that this is more accurate or more, it serves your interest also politically better than this description? So I'm coming here from Bruno Latour's idea of debunking impetus of critique, and he's very critical of that. He says that this way of always proposing something behind the phenomenon, so for example, an illusion, he of course problematizes this on a more epistemological level, but I am all more interested on the strategic, maybe more pedagogical level. How would you respond to that?
Yeah. Well,
sorry for being so critical, by the way.
No. That's the project. I may not have been expressing myself entirely carefully, but let me say two things. The first is that the idea of a radical theory of illusions that I try to develop in this book is precisely the idea that it's not as if we are lifting a veil to see the truth. Okay, that is a way of thinking that I associate with ideology critique and with the early Frankfurt School and with more post-Marxist theories of ideology, that somehow we could lift the veil and then you will see your true interests, right? This notion that there is truth hidden behind there. Most often is associated with the notion of false consciousness, right? In other words, once we lift the veil, you will see that you had a false consciousness, that it was wrong, and that it wasn't pursuing your real interests.
Yeah, that's very prominent in Freire, for example.
Yes,
because you mentioned
that's very prominent in Freire because Freire was very classically Marxist in that sense, and depended on a theory of ideology. Now, the theory of illusions that I'm trying to construct is one in which there is no truth hidden behind the illusion. So there is no way to tell someone, look, let me unveil this and now you will see the truth and you can figure out what your true interests are. The theory of illusion I have is that actually, you know, we're being often we are ourselves misguided by ideas that we hold, and we can loosen them, but we're not going to end up in a place of permanent truth, or truth for that matter, but another place where we'll need to continue to re-examine and think. And so the example I give often in the book, maybe, but also in the classroom, is when you think about Simone de Beauvoir, who was extraordinary with her book, The Second Sex, at unveiling the ways of masculine domination between the two sexes at mid-20th century. The work there was extraordinary. It helped to combat forms of gender hierarchy and of male superiority, At the same time, though, it didn't reveal a truth. At the same time, what it did, though, is it had a tendency to reify two genders, the feminine and the masculine, and to create a bit of a binary view of gender relations, one calling for equality of the sexes, which is necessary, but one that also had a tendency to reify that binary. And I think what we saw in the decades that followed was certainly an appreciation for the notions of equality, but also a skepticism about the binarity of gender. And so queer theory, Judith Butler and others, then I think challenge that notion of binary, create a notion of queerness that is much less, that ambiguates the feminine and the masculine, right? Now, just when you think about it, of course, you almost couldn't have gotten to notions of queerness if you hadn't first kind of demonstrated and opposed and confronted the kind of male superiority over women that was, and tragically continues, but that was so prevalent at mid-20th century. You almost couldn't get to queering until you had first exposed the binarity and the hierarchies and whatnot. And that, in a way, is this idea that I have of illusions, that, you know, the move we're making today is going to be useful for our critical theory and for our praxis, for what we're actually doing. But it may also create new problems that we're going to need to untangle. And so it's in that way that I would try to present this, not as if like anybody holds truth or knowledge because we don't. Instead, it's how can we together in our exchange in our solidaristic and respectful and equal exchanges, question some of our own ideas that will then, knowing that we can make progress while at the same time knowing that we're going to need to continue to question wherever we get. And that's the notion of kind of infinite illusions in a way. So I don't know if that's a little bit more helpful in articulating it, because I agree with you, and part of the book is aimed at critiquing this notion that that the debunking leads to a truth, and that I or some other critical theory person are the only ones who hold this truth and who can engage in that work.
Yeah, that was very helpful. Thank you very much for the elaboration. I feel like we've talked a lot now about the first two parts of the book, which is really an attempt of collecting many thoughts of the critical tradition. But I also want to quickly turn to the other two parts, which are more really a description of practices. And the third part is a very generous embrace of a huge variety of critical practices. And the fourth part is a description of your own practice in part. And also, I felt sometimes really also turning the practice of critique into an almost existential question. So maybe you can give an outlook on these two parts.
Yes. Clearly, we need another hour because we've been no. It's me. We've been kind of discussing a lot the critical theory side and the illusions side and the value side. What the book is intended to do is to push critical theory to those two last chapters, to the third part and the fourth part, the the part that deals with a praxis and to push critical theory in the direction of debating, challenging, figuring out, questioning what we must actually do, what I must actually do. And I go through in part three just a large number of different forms of praxis today, from hacking and hacktivism and whistleblowing to forms of uprising to also to forms of more what could be considered conventional political organizing. So, for instance, left populism, which is something that Chantal Mouffe has been arguing for, or possibly the practices of Bernie Sanders in the United States. So at one extreme, those more what are often not thought of as critical practices, but which I think fit perfectly within, from some perspective, would fit perfectly within a critical theory, to the more radical revolutionary uprisings, political disobedience, forms of occupations, whether it's at Occupy Wall Street or at Tahrir Square, to hunger strikes and other forms of self-immolation. So I really, in the book, I really try to take on a wide panoply of praxises that could form part of a critical agenda so that we spend more time as critical theorists figuring out what is to be done, not in that kind of dogmatic way, not in that kind of prescriptive way, but what we are, what each of us should be doing, whether it's a manifestation, whether it's a form of disobedience that might be more relegated to the personal realms or to the public realms or more self-transformatory or not. So, whether it's populist or whether it's, or whether it's just, engaging in what Sara Ahmed calls certain forms of heightened engagements in our daily lives. So that's what I try to do. And then, of course, ultimately in the last part, I turn that on myself, and I look at my own interventions. Often I intervene in the legal sphere because I have that legal training and I have the ability. So right now I'm involved with another attorney, Noah Smith Drellick, in a lawsuit involving the repression at Standing Rock. But of course, the question then becomes, how does that function? Is that how we should be spending our time? How does it relate to issues of political organizing and those are the questions really that I try to address, focusing ultimately on my own work. I personally have had a significant transformation over the past 30 years that I've been doing this work. I started more as a civil rights attorney when 30 years ago, and I've become, through a process of engagement and confrontation and readings, and especially reading all of the remarkable abolitionist work from Angela Davis and Dorothy Roberts and Ruth Gilmore and now Mariam Kaba and others, I have become much more of an abolitionist, a democratic thinker, believer in abolition democracy, this notion that Du Bois kind of developed and that was extended to the prison industrial complex, really by Angela Davis and then by other thinkers after her. That has transformed the way that I engage in my own praxis. And I try to describe that and talk about it in the book so as to just allow for some space for others, I think, to think about their own work and their own actions from a critical theoretic perspective.
And I must say that these two parts were also extremely stimulating to read, and I really love this generous view of what counts as critical practice, because often I feel that, especially in the critical sphere, there is a lot of divide between what counts as reformist or revolutionarist or whatever not. So I really like this your generous view.
Yeah, we're in a moment right now, actually, in the United States, particularly as a result of the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others, with an uprising movement of abolition, where these questions really become important because there is so much animosity within circles that have similar ambitions about whether, you know, it's too abolitionist or it's too reformist, and I don't think that that's helpful. I don't think that that kind of excluding and marginalizing positions because they don't fit the one's own critical perspective is productive. And so I think we need to be generous. What we need to be doing is having conversations, but from and disagreement. And disagreement is, you know, we can't mask that disagreement, but we need to be coming at it from an open and generous perspective. And one in which, you know, other people will be doing other things, and that's fine. We just need to figure out, you know, I just need to figure out what I need to be doing.
So, Bernhard, we've taken up a lot of your time with which you could have done
yes.
different things. So my last question is, what are you currently working on?
Yeah. Well, the writing of the book had many consequences for me in terms of my own engagements, and so I'm working on many things. I mean, once you're involved in these death penalty cases, you continue with them forever because they last for decades, and the same is true of Guantanamo case, etc. So I continue with that work, of course, but the writing of the book has made me feel as if it's important to create more of a collective team, to both think about these issues and engage in praxis. And so I've been helping put together the Initiative for a Just Society, which is bringing on remarkable abolitionists, thinkers, and practitioners. Right now, Che Gossett is joining us, who is a scholar in residence, who's a remarkable, challenging, queer abolitionist thinker, and Omavi Shakur, who is a practitioner, who's joining us as well, who has been litigating these police shooting cases. And so putting together a team to really work together as almost as a cooperative and figure out how to challenge the punitive society most effectively. And at an intellectual critical theoretic perspective, I've been working most on notions of cooperation, which I think is prevalent in a lot of the abolitionist writings. Actually, the notion of cooperation and cooperatives was something that Du Bois himself wrote about at the same time in 1935. As he was writing Black Reconstruction in America, he wrote a small essay called A Negro Nation Within the Nation, where he had this vision of a kind of a separatist, cooperative African-American society. But built on cooperatives, and so I've been I've been working with that notion with cooperation and trying to see how that might be a way forward as well. So those are the projects I'm that in part have grown out of this book and that I am struggling with, confronting with critical theory all the time, but struggling and trying to, let me just say, propose, right? In that way that I think we must propose and build and construct institutions that would make it possible for all of us to be on equal footing and to be full citizens. So those are a couple of the projects, and I've carried it through this year a lot through this series of conversations and debates and interventions that I've called Abolition Democracy 1313, which is has been going on all year and basically has been looking at all of the different movements for abolition, whether it's movements to abolish the police or the prison or family regulation, what used to be called, or what still is called, child welfare system, which is tragically not at all about child welfare, but also looking at the abolition of oil and borders and capital. And so we've had a full year with 13 different conversations about these issues and how to bring in cooperation and how to work towards a just society. So those are the things that I've been doing this year, and in large part, they all really grow out of this book, Critique and Praxis.
Well, Bernard, that sounds both politically and intellectually very stimulating. Thank you very much for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you, Kai. This has been a great conversation for me, really helpful at thinking through these issues, and I've enjoyed the critique of critical theory as well that we've been having. Thank you.